No risk it, no biscuit.
Coming from the Arizona desert, presented by SBNation.com. For Arizona Cardinals fans, by Arizona Cardinals fans, with outsider and insider's perspective, this is Revenge of the Birds. Good evening, Arizona Cardinals fans. It is Revenge of the Birds Radio on the air tonight on this Tuesday night. Out here in the lovely weather of the Phoenix, Arizona area, I'm your host, Jess Root. Welcome again to another episode of Revenge of the Birds Radio. It seems like we haven't talked in a while, and it's probably so. Normally, last week we would have had, normally we have two shows. We have our Tuesday night show reviewing the previous game that the Arizona Cardinals played, followed by a Thursday night episode in which we look to the upcoming game. Now, last week we had the abbreviated schedule. The Arizona Cardinals hosted the Seattle Seahawks on Thursday night football. And so we combined our shows last week. We had Seth Cox on, as we do frequently, as we do almost every week. And we had Trey Niner from NinersNation.com. And we both reviewed and previewed. And so it's been a little while. The Arizona Cardinals lost on Thursday night to the Seattle Seahawks, 34-22. It was not a it wasn't a good game. They kind of had a chance, but it really early on, the Seattle Seahawks began to have their way with the Cardinals as they beat up the Cardinals defensively to start things off. They went up to a 14-point lead. The defense really handled the Arizona Cardinals offensive line as Carson Palmer was sacked 7 times. He threw another 2 interceptions, and he was pressured on over half of his dropbacks. Meanwhile, the defense was not able to be the same dominating self as they had been. And that led to 34 points allowed. They jumped out to 14-0 lead, and it really was kind of tough. Bradley Saul didn't look good. He was beaten several times. And Larry Fitzgerald had a rather pedestrian game. Andre Ellington did not make an impact. The running game was not great. In every phase, it seemed that the Seattle Seahawks were just the better team. As it shows, the Arizona Cardinals now sit at 3-4 on the season. They are 0-3 in the division and are currently in last place in the division. Technically, they are tied with the Rams at 3-4 each. However, the Rams having already beaten the Cardinals head-to-head, that would give them technically a tiebreaker, putting the Cardinals in last place. And again, this is Jess Root from Revenge of the Birds. If you would like to give us a call tonight, please join us, 646-478-3787. And we have Seth Cox on the line with us tonight, as we always do. Welcome aboard, Seth. How is your day going?
Good, Jess. How are you doing, man?
I'm doing all right. I had myself a regular work day, and it was interesting, as it seems like we haven't talked, and it seems forever since it's only been a week, but having the extra couple of days after the game, a couple of days earlier, it seems like we've forgotten the Seattle game. And I, for one, wouldn't mind forgetting it, because it really was kind of reminiscent to me in many ways to the Thursday night game a season ago when the Rams kind of beat the Cardinals like a drum. I don't know how that was for you.
You know, it was similar, and one of the things was just that embarrassment. I mean, to watch that game and think that you had a chance and that, you know, you keep waiting for this team to play to the level that we all expected, And, you know, I don't want to say it's already over because it's not. I mean, they're 3-4, and they're, I think, one game out of a playoff spot right now. But you look at it, and you're still waiting. You're still waiting to see, you know, is this team going to get it all together? And, you know, we thought, okay, maybe this is the week, maybe a short week. Seattle had to travel to Tennessee and then traveled here. It just kind of felt like it all lined up, and then the game actually happened. And it was just kind of a nightmare, you know, the same nightmare that we've seen 100 different times. So it was, you know, it was frustrating and then a little depressing to watch. But, you know, we have this week, we have Atlanta, so, you know, maybe things will get a little better.
And that's kind of the plight of the Arizona Cardinals fan. I myself, if you recall, the last thing I said on the podcast last week or on the show was my bold prediction that the Cards were going to finally put it together and win going away. I predicted even pregame, I predicted a 27-17 Cardinals victory, maybe 24-17, I don't remember, one of the two. And I really thought that there was a whole lot of things that were in place for the Cardinals to win. Seattle is by no means 100%. They have issues on their offensive line. They are not completely healthy. They were missing Bobby Wagner. They still don't have. They didn't get Percy Harvin back yet. It was just a number of things. Plus, that Seattle traditionally has not played well in Arizona, and they have not played well on Thursday night. And guess what? Russell Wilson made me wish that he was our quarterback. And you're just like, and then we're after a loss like that, that's two consecutive division losses where they lose by 12, and after their defense is getting rave reviews about how good they are, they're giving up over 30 points a game. And I know that isn't all on the defense, but as strong as the defense is supposed to be, you can't be giving up over 30 points a game, especially when you have an offense that is not, I mean, it's not the same dreadful levels as a year ago, because last year was absolutely just painful to watch. But it's painful for other reasons, just because they can't get on the same page. It's not just ineptness, as it is just mind-boggling lack of communication. You just can't quite pinpoint exactly what the problem is.
Well, and you look at it, and it's like, you know, I kind of highlighted it, and some of the fans kind of disagreed with me, and they said, oh, you can't blame it on this guy, you can't blame it on this guy. And I think that's what kind of the problem is of this team, is everybody, including the coach, is looking to place the blame outside of Carson Palmer and the offensive line. And it really just comes down to two things. You can't sit here and tell me that Seattle's, you know, injury-ravaged offensive line that they brought in on a short week is that much better than the Arizona Cardinals' injury-ravaged offensive line. And mind you, the only injury they had along the offensive line until Darren College went out was Jonathan Cooper. Everybody else was handpicked by this staff to be in the position they were in, including Bradley Sowell. So, you know, this is who the management team wanted in there. But the combination of Arian's scheme and Carson Palmer has just, you know, like you said, you watch Russell Wilson, and I think he was pressured as many times as Carson Palmer. The difference was he was able to get the ball out. Carson Palmer can't get the ball out because he just doesn't have that ability to maneuver in the pocket, make people miss, and extend play, something that we've talked about numerous times. And so now you look at it, and, you know, they're sitting at 3-4 and coming off another, you know, embarrassing loss.
Well, and getting on talking about Russell Wilson a little bit and is what the difference is. Yes, one, he has escapability. Two, there's something about that Wilson that I just can't get away from, and he has something about him. It's an intangible that you just gravitate to. And I'm not saying that Carson Palmer is a bad leader, because there's one thing I've noticed that I've been very impressed with Carson Palmer has been his demeanor and his ability to keep grinding and keep doing things and not look like the one I can remember a season ago, the Thursday night game when Kevin Cobb got sacked 9 times, is that he had a look on his face like, I can't do this anymore. I just keep, like, it was utter frustration, and you never see that out of Carson Palmer. But what the other thing that Russell Wilson has is that he is comfortable in the offense. He's comfortable in his offense, and it is clear that neither Carson Palmer, and it appears that no one in that offensive unit is yet comfortable completely with what their assignments are offensively.
I preached on this podcast. I wrote about it. This offense takes time. More than football, I understood that coming, just going through the film, a lot of things that they did and didn't do in Indianapolis, and then I went back and watched all the Pittsburgh film I could get my hands on, and we talked a little bit about Palmer's fit as the ideal Arians quarterback, and I think the combination, like I said, of the fact that Palmer can't move and the offensive line can't block for a long period of time has just made this scheme so so bad, such a bad mesh, or just such a bad fit, that this is kind of what you're stuck with. You're going to be stuck with an offense that shows flashes of really good on maybe a drive or two drives in the game, but it shows a lot of bad, and then when there are plays that are open, like the Fitzgerald interception, that wasn't all on Palmer. You can't get mad at him because of the interception, because Earl Thomas made a spectacular play, but he clearly underthrew that ball. I mean, that ball was 2 or 3 yards underthrown of where it should have been, and that's because he was waiting to get hit, so he rushed what he was doing. He didn't put everything on it. His base wasn't really into it when you watch him throw it. And that's just, that's just the signs of a guy that he knows he's going to get hit. And so instead of playing like it, he's kind of flinching at it already. And so, it's just been a, it was probably a bad marriage to begin with. Not the Arians-Palmer marriage, but the Palmer and this offensive line marriage. And now, we're kind of seeing it to fruition at this point with the frustration of what the offense hasn't gotten to.
Well, before we end up just wallowing in everything bad, let's do a couple of things. Let's take the good and the bad. One thing good that you took away from that game, if you can find one. And one thing, what was the biggest issue for? We'll go with the good first. Actually, let's go with the bad, because then we can end with the good and then move on with some other things that might have some better, some bad. So, what was the one thing that you took away as the biggest issue?
The biggest issue I had was, and I talked about it on Twitter on game night, and then I've talked about it a couple times since, was just how embarrassing it was to watch Bradley Soule and Eric Winston get, kind of just eaten alive on the offensive line. And it was in two separate plays. You had the play where Michael Bennett threw Bradley Soule on a down block, so he was trying to down block Michael Bennett, and he just threw him down like a rag doll and went in and sacked Palmer for a 14-yard loss on the first drop back of the game, or the first sack of the game that was given up. And then you had the zone stretch play where Eric Winston pulled around the tight end to kind of kick out the safety and was just absolutely stonewalled by Cam Chancellor, who's not a small player. I mean, Chancellor's not small by any means, but it just, it kind of set the tone for the rest of the game that, you don't want to say that the Seahawks do not respect the Cardinals, but they don't fear the Cardinals, and that's what one of the things I had hoped for this season was, is that teams wouldn't want to play the Cardinals. They may beat the Cardinals. The Cardinals could have ended up going 1-15, but they were going to be in every game, and teams feared them coming in every week. And it kind of feels like it's getting to the point where teams just kind of laugh because they know that, hey, we get to go up against this offensive line with this quarterback. You know, we're gonna have opportunity to pick three balls off a game. So that's just, you know, it's kind of getting to that frustration point.
And for me, the one thing that I just, the biggest issue for me continues to be just, nothing seems to be clicking all at once offensively. So everything, just no unit is playing well. You've got receivers that aren't running their routes right. You've got receivers not knowing where they're supposed to be. Carson Palmer, who can't get away from pressures. You've got the offensive line. For me, it's just a constant fight to do something, to get anything going. And again, they're better than last year. If you remember, last year was just atrocious to watch because it seemed to be three and out, three and out, three and out. And this year we're not getting as many three and outs. We're getting, okay, we're getting the first down here, interception. First down here, oh, stall. And so things are doing better. But it's just incredibly frustrating to see the week after week kind of nothing ever coming together. Just if one thing started to do, the other thing's falling apart. So the receivers are running good routes, the ball's in the wrong place. Carson Palmer knows where he's supposed to make his read, and the receiver's in the wrong spot. The running back is running through the hole it's supposed to, and there is no hole. Or the offensive line opens a hole it's supposed to be there, and the running back misses it. It's been constantly frustrating, and you're starting to hear some of the same things. And I don't know what the Arizona Cardinals fans hoped for, but we're starting to hear some of the things. Bruce Arians say almost exactly some of the same things that Ken Wisenhut was saying a season ago. We knew, deep down we knew it wasn't going to happen overnight, but there was enough optimism to think, hey, this could, if everything falls into place, this could be good. And not everything has fallen into place, and I guess that's the biggest thing for me. What about your good? Let's go to the positive side. What was the good thing what was the silver lining you got out of Thursday night, if anything?
Well, there's always silver linings in every game, and that's one of the things that I've been happy about so far this season, is that I've been able to find something positive every week, despite the loss, not just the losses, but some of the really bad offensive play. Again, Tyrann Mathieu was outstanding. I thought he played really well throughout the game. But I think for me, the best sign of the night was the effectiveness of John Abraham and the pass rush, getting 16 hurries, but then getting 8 quarterback knockdowns or sacks total. And that was just, that was kind of something that we hadn't seen all season. And so for them to do that, defensively, they've kind of taken a step back in the run defense, but to see the pass rush get after it, I think that was fun to see for once.
Yeah. You stole my thunder again. the positive for me was the pass rush, is the fact that Russell Wilson was pressured constantly. I think it was like 54.7% of his dropbacks. Carson Palmer was pressured and was somewhere between 51% and 52% of the dropbacks that Wilson had that he was pressured. So that was great to see. Calais Campbell had a great game. John Abraham, remember the beginning of the offseason, he finally got sacks and he finally had two of them. I'm going to bring this up reluctantly just after Darnell Dockett picked up his two sacks earlier in the season. It was against an undrafted rookie guy, and And John Abraham was going up against a guy named Pat McQuiston, not exactly world beater, but he did get a couple of sacks. So he's playing a lot more. It's very positive to see that. I hope we see that more because Abraham has more or less, well, Bruce Arians has said he's been really good in run support. He, on the stat sheet in the past, which he's really been non-impactful, if I had to pick it. He's been non-impactful and finally had an impact on a game on and Matt Shaughnessy. I was it was very impressive to see Shaughnessy pick up his first sack, and he was all over the field as well. And I don't know if this was part of the game plan, but I was very interested because the defense opened up in nickel. So they didn't open in base, they opened in nickel. And in that first unit that was on the field, it wasn't Matt Shaughnessy on the field. They had John Abraham on one side, and they had Marcus Bernard, a guy they picked up a while ago. It was Marcus Bernard on the other side that lined up. He ended up playing 11 snaps. But then Shaughnessy was playing in base. He got some pressure. He was making some plays. And then, what do you know, nickel package later in the game, not too far into the game, and it's Shaughnessy still out there. So that was, I was pleased to see the pass rush finally make an impact, even though it didn't have the results, per se, that we would have liked in the way of turnover, well, in the way of flustering Wilson, because he made some, oh my goodness, he made some actually absolutely outstanding throws. The one where, you know, had another been a quarterback, it probably would have been called in the grass. I've seen that play called in the grass. I've seen it happen, and he got the ball up, and it was a completion. It was fantastic. There were a couple of plays that were just absolutely like, but I loved the pass rush. I was very, very pleased about that. Now, moving on to our next topic is, as we delve back into the dirty and the ugly and the sad and just the things that probably don't want to, we're going to wall in the offensive line issues. Do you honestly, let's be frank, is there any hope this season that we're going to get at least adequate play, or are we looking at I keep thinking, because the offensive line, if you look at the sack stats, in the first six games, 13 sacks. It's not great, but by no means is it awful. 7 sacks on Thursday night. In the first 4 weeks with last season with Kevin Cobb at quarterback, it seemed like there were, I can't remember the exact number, 4 games or might have been 10 sacks, maybe 9 or 10 sacks, and then boom, 9 sacks after that. And then after that, the floodgates opened. And it was like, ha, we knew this was smoke and mirrors. And then it's pressure. Is there any hope for this season, for this offensive line? Is there an inkling at all that we're going to get at least adequate play?
Depends on if Darren College comes back healthy. I think if you have Nate Potter and Bradley Sowell on one side of the offensive line, it could end up being a probably one of the worst offensive line combination we'll ever see. They're just both so weak at the point of attack, and they're not going to be able to hold up in this Arians deep attack. This, you know, I keep banging the drum on the scheme, but that, you know, they're two of the worst fits scheme wise in what Arians wants to do. So, you know, if College comes back and Sowell continues to get reps, you hate to say it couldn't get worse, because, you know, we've seen it on both sides of the coin at this point, but I really don't see how it could get, you know, that much worse than what it already is. I think he's given up in his 3 starts. Yeah, he's given up 3 sacks, but he's given up more pressures than Levi Brown did in his 4 starts. So it's just, you know, it's going to continue to be bad because he struggles versus speed, he struggles versus power. He doesn't get any kind of push in the run game. But I think with College there, it can become manageable. I think with if College is out for any amount of time and you end up with a Sowell, Potter, Sinline, Fanica, Winston offensive line, you could be looking at one of the worst offensive lines maybe in the history of the league.
I'm looking at Pro Football Focus right now. We're looking at the pressure stats between Levi Brown and Bradley Saul. Levi Brown in the games that he played gave up 4 sacks, 6 hits, and 8 hurries. So essentially a total of 18 hurries in the games that he played. And mind you, they were ready to just cut ties with him completely. Levi Brown is the worst thing to have ever come to cross the on the line of scrimmage. Since Leonard Davis, he was just terrible. Now we look at Bradley Saul. Since he started, he's given up 3 sacks, 6 hits, and 15 hurries. So he's given up 24 pressures in 3 games. I know why they made the move. They'd seen everything Levi was going to do, and they were saying there's the money issue. He's being paid a lot of money. Saul is an unknown. They said, well, Bruce Arians' words when he was picked up off waivers. I think he's an excellent tackle prospect. Excellent tackle prospect for us. I'm like, okay. Great tackles, or even very good tackles, tend to be all drafted at the beginning of the draft. They're the most athletic. But, yeah, that one's tough. And I do hope for during college that he can be the Iron Man we need him to be, as he has not had a bad year by any means. And the fact that he's that veteran on that left side of the line is going to be helpful. Are you more concerned about Saul on the left side, is we kind of knew that left tackle play was going to be bad between Levi and Brad. But what about the play on the right side? Eric Winston, who has been anything but impressive thus far.
Well, you have to remember when he was signed, I was probably one of the few people that was not, didn't think super highly of the signing. And I simply... And it wasn't that I didn't think he could be a good addition to this line. My concern was you're picking up more scraps. You're not picking up a John Abraham because he's old and he's cost a lot of money and, he's a limited player. That's fine. That's a completely different scenario. You didn't bring in John Abraham to play 80 snaps a game. You brought him in to play maybe 30. You brought in Eric Winston to be your starting right tackle, allegedly to compete with Bobby Massey. But I don't really feel, and maybe this is just me hypothesizing, but I don't feel like the coaching staff had any intention of letting Massey play until Winston had just been so bad during the season. And the fact that he's continually been bad and he hasn't gotten any better, I think that has kind of spawned this, okay, maybe we need to activate Bobby Massey because it's getting to the point of, ridiculousness where we're allowing so many pressures because Eric Winston, his strength coming in, much like Levi Brown's, was his ability to run block. Both of them struggled in pass protection. Well, you're talking about an offensive scheme that requires you to hold blocks for an inordinate amount of time, much longer than most schemes do. And, with a quarterback that's not going to extend the plays himself, he can move up in the pocket, maybe make one guy miss, but he's not going to roll out and extend plays. So... all that being said, it kind of was, okay, this is what I expected out of Eric Winston in this scheme. He's not bad in the run game, but they don't run the ball. So now, you're getting what you kind of expected out of him as a pass protector. So, at this point, it's sad, but I just feel like it was kind of, I saw it coming. I know other people wanted to believe that, this is Eric Winston. I think he was a Pro Bowler 3 years ago or whatever, so he's got to have something left, But you don't get cut by two teams in 2 years if you have anything left in the tank, especially in a league that's so important to protect the quarterback.
Well, and it kind of it's a testament to the fact that the offensive line and quality tackles are really few and far between right now. When teams are trading for Levi Brown or Bryant McKinney, that you're really in a situation where what? Okay, you're trading for a guy that has been underperforming in the case of Levi Brown that has been viewed as underperforming for years. Hey, but I mean you can say Levi Brown was a Pro Bowler because he was a Pro Bowler 1 year. He was a Pro Bowler once. It's really, I don't know. Do I have hope? I always have hope. I'm a sucker like that. I have hope that the line will improve at least marginally and the issues that we're having offensively. I mean, it comes down to protection, but when your receivers aren't going to the right spots and it just makes it hard and everyone's making their read slowly, I can see why some of that maybe isn't fair. But it is fair at the end. Do I have hope? I think there is hope. I don't think it's a lot of hope. The upside of the fact is that, well, we're starting to see what Bradley Sal can do, and I'm hoping he approaches more Levi Brown than D'Anthony Batiste. And the coaching staff and the general manager clearly felt that he wasn't going to be a downgrade, that it couldn't get worse. I mean, apparently this is Levi Brown play, although the numbers say otherwise. But as long as he, if he can play like Nate Potter did at the end of last year, then I think we're going to be better and it'll be okay at some point. Now, the other axe to grind that everyone seems to be having is we're talking about Carson Palmer. He had two more interceptions. He's got 13 on the season. And with Eli Manning not throwing any interceptions, Carson Palmer now has the chance to catch Eli Manning in interceptions this Sunday. And we're hoping that doesn't happen, obviously. But Palmer is very, very – I mean, he had 14 all last year. He's got 13 now. He's – I can't remember the stat. He's never had more than 20 in a season. I mean, 20 is a lot, but he's never been – he's known to be careless. I mean, he has a reputation of being careless with the football. Fantasy football people, I mean, to say, come into the season, the National, they view him as a guy that is turnover prone, that doesn't care how many people are in coverage. He's going to try and get the ball in that spot. And we talked a little bit about that last week. Is there any hope for Carson Palmer? At least for Carson Palmer, I think there is hope. Because you have a guy who's uncomfortable in an offense, who is throwing to places where receivers are supposed to be, and he's not, and he's playing behind a line that's not protecting for him. Yes, he has had a few what-the-heck kind of throws you're doing, but like Bruce Arians has said, a lot of those interceptions really aren't his fault. And while they still are interceptions, you look at the throws and the decision-making most of the time, and you say, okay, that's an okay decision if this doesn't happen, or there's... And so you get the feeling, you know, one of these games he's going to turn it on and not just have a blah, blasé Carson Palmer game where he throws a couple of interceptions and makes a couple of good drives, but that he's going to have a good game from start to finish. Do you hold out any optimism for that?
Well, I kind of tweeted this out earlier, but if there's hope, this is the week. And obviously, I know we still have Jacksonville on the schedule, so you know, don't tweet me. Oh, what about Jacksonville? But in the last two games, the Atlanta Falcons defense has surrendered over 500 yards. Here it is, over 450 yards and 5 touchdowns to 2 rookie quarterbacks. That's Geno Smith and Mike Glennon. Now, granted, they won and beat Tampa Bay, but they allowed 23 points to that Tampa Bay offense with Doug Martin not playing much, with, you know, Mike Glennon, the same Mike Glennon that we saw at the helm. This Falcons pass defense is not very good. This is the week for you know, the offense to kind of get on track. And I know then they got the bye week, and then they have a struggling Houston team. But you really, as a team, you don't want to go into the bye week 3-5. But you also don't want to go into the bye week as one of the worst offensive teams statistically in the NFL. You know, all we heard about all offseason was, look at all the changes we made on offense. Now, granted, probably the most important addition they had on offense got hurt before he even played a real game. But you have, you know, you added a tackle in Eric Winston that was supposed to be good. You added a running back in Rashard Mendenhall who was supposed to be able to, you know, help soften up defenses. You added a quarterback in Carson Palmer who could make all the throws. We heard, you know, all offseason that this offense was going to be better. This offense is going to, you know, we even had a lot of talk of, could this offense be a top 10 offense in the NFL?
Well, that sounds silly right now.
I got sucked into,
but goodness, I thought more like upper half, but I got sucked in. I did.
But I mean, now at this point it's, and it, you know, that kind of just shows you where I don't know even how to describe it, just where it went. Like, where did our perspective go on this team? It went from, can this offense be a top 10 offense, to can we get one good week? I mean, can you please get us one good week on offense, you know, where you put it all together? But, you know, all in all, I think this is the week that they do it. Maybe I'm just a sucker, but I think this is the week they are able to put it all together. Atlanta doesn't really have a pass rush. I know they have OC Umeniora, but he's not, you know, he's not the OCU Maniora of old. He's not a one-man wrecking crew like they faced recently. And then they have some nice players on the inside, Corey Peters, Jerry Pariah, Jonathan Babineau. They have some nice players, but they're not going to bring the pressure unless they just blitz all the time, which they don't do. But they're just not going to bring the pressure that the Cardinals have faced all year. So I think the offensive line can kind of, you know, maybe give up one or two sacks, but not give up 20 hurries. And then we'll see, you know, Carson Palmer kind of get on track for this week and carry a good vibe into the bye week. And then after that, who knows what happens. But yeah, I mean, with the talent that they still have, this sounds stupid just based on the play that we've seen. I don't see any reason they shouldn't be able to succeed, at least, you know, at least improve from where they have been.
Well, it's Carson Palmer, offensive line. Carson Palmer gives us a little bit of hope. Offensive line, not so much. This was a topic, this is a question, and I, when I wrote the piece on Sunday, I believe it was, I was not trying to say that Larry Fitzgerald is done. It was to begin the dialogue to perhaps raise the question, what if? I mean, is it time that we start asking that question? The question came up again as he is having a very pedestrian year. He's actually had less, aside from the touchdowns, he's had less production through seven games right now than he did a season ago, where he had a very disappointing season. Now that the quarterback play just fell off the table last year and just wallowed on the floor like a fish out of water. But other than with, I was looking back on some of Cardinals stats and looking over the years, going to name drop in there. And my seat in the press box, I actually sit, last year I sat right next to Larry's dad in the press box. And Larry's dad sits a couple of seats down from me now, but that's inconsequential. But last year at the throes of all the struggles that the Cardinals had, there was a discussion and we was talking to his dad about, well, you know, Larry has had some, you know, has been around for some really not very good quarterback play and still put up big numbers, and I cited some of the players. And then I looked back, and I looked back at the quarterbacks that the Cardinals have had. And truth be told, the worst of what the Arizona Cardinals had with their Larry Fitzgerald was his rookie year, and it's when he was the least productive. He had, now granted it wasn't the Hall of Fame, the all-wonderful Kurt Warner that he was when he was going to the Super Bowl, but he had Kurt Warner throw into him for much of his seasons in all but his rookie year. It was Josh McCown, and in 2005, it was Josh McCown and Kurt Warner. In 2006, it was Kurt Warner and Matt Leinart. 2007, it was Kurt Warner and Matt Leinart. 2008, 2009, it was Kurt Warner. Then it was Derek Anderson, Max Hall, John Skelton. Then it was John Skelton, Kevin Cobb, John Skelton, Ryan Lindley, and Brian Hoyer. And that's where we saw the numbers drop. Now, I was under the belief that he was – I misplaced a year. It was Anquan Boldin that was there before. It was when he had the John Navarre, when he had the mess that was there before. Now, he did – by no means, Josh McCown was not a great quarterback. Carson Palmer's definitely better than he was. Matt Leinart turned out to be really, after a promising beginning to his rookie year, kind of fell apart. But between the quarterback play, he's now 30 years old. He's been injured, and so yes, there's that. He's in a new offense, and he's being asked to play other positions. Is he being used right? Is he still elite? And that's the question. There's a lot of reasons for Larry's lack of production, but I wanted to raise the question as well. But what if? Is it fair to ask, is he no longer the same player? And I don't think that's the case, but there's a lot going on now. Do you think, as I've been talking for a while, Seth, what do you think? Do you think, is the team misusing Larry Fitzgerald? I mean, I understand what Bruce Arians is saying about him being flexible, that he needs to learn to play outside. It will extend his career because playing outside and playing X, he's not going to be able to provide to get separation for the rest of his career if he wants to play forever. So he does. But are they using him too much inside? And is it just too much in a new system to have him do everything that he's being asked? Are the Cardinals messing with Larry Fitzgerald? Or what are your thoughts on that?
Well, one of the first things that I wanted to look at was what's the percentage of targets that he and Michael Floyd are getting. As much as we thought this was a 3-4, you know, maybe 5 receiver type offense, this has become painfully obvious that there's only really 2 weapons on this team. It's, you know, Floyd and Fitz. Soapbox for Seth, why you don't invest only in receivers. But you look at what they've done. 21% of Carson Palmer's throws have gone to either Fitzgerald or Floyd. You put that in perspective with some of the other guys in the league. Calvin Johnson's actually right at the same percentage. AJ Green is at a much higher. He's at a 30%, so he gets 9% more, you know, attention from Dalton than Fitz does Palmer. But you can kind of jump that into having Floyd out there as well. So I don't think they're utilizing him enough in the sense that I don't think he's getting enough good targets. You look at his targets in the league, he's actually 20th. He's tied with guys like Alshon Jeffrey, Anquan Boldin, Kendall Wright, who are basically, outside of Boldin, they're basically second receivers, or they're number one receivers on run-heavy teams. But the Cardinals aren't really a run-heavy team. You look at Floyd, he has 5 less targets at 50. And so, you know, they're getting pretty much the same amount of play. Yet, both of their catch percentage, so percentage of passes they catch based on targets they get, are actually really on like the lower half of starters in the league. Michael Floyd is at 62%, and that would put him at 45 in the league. Fitz is all the way down at 59th in the league at 58%. So basically, they're getting targets. He's getting the targets that you'd want, but he's not getting good targets, and that's where it comes down to. So again, is he being utilized in the offense correctly? It doesn't seem like it, because he's getting throws that he's getting the targets he should, but he's not getting the targets where he should. Does that kind of make sense with what
I get?
I ramble?
It. Yes. You shouldn't. I mean, you need to every once in a while. You need to focus. You want to get Larry with a wide receiver screen just to get him the ball and see what happens. You want to get him underneath, but he needs to be down the field. That's the true fact of the matter. Is you need to have him down the field because he still is dynamic, or should be. We hope he's still dynamic at creating mismatches down the field, getting separation, and then making plays. And what too often and. And unfortunately, that's what's where a lot of those interceptions are happening, is Carson is either a smidge late, is a little early, or he's just a little off target, and he's trying to force the ball to Fitz, and I get why he's doing it. I mean, Carson understands how this game works. I mean, after all, he did have Chad Johnson, had Chad Ochocinco, and Terrell Owens on the same team with him. And so he knew he had to feed them the ball. And it's not because Larry necessarily has to have the ball, but he knows that's a really good option. The point is, and this, when Bruce Arians was on Arizona Sports the other day, he was on the radio, and the question came up because Kurt Warner on the same radio station had questioned using Larry so much on the inside. He said because he is so special at the X or outside, that moving him inside so much takes away what makes Larry Larry, and you have him a lot of underneath. He has to think more than he has to just play, as opposed to what's doing what is natural for him. And I think that's what's happening. I know that Reggie Wayne thrived when he was moved inside a lot. In fact, he was moved inside a lot of nickel situations. I know that's what they've been doing with Larry, because they'll have Michael on the outside, they'll have Floyd on the outside, and then they'll move Fitz inside for a lot of nickel or three and four wide sets so that they create mismatches. But, and Arians in response to that said that they used a couple of games, so I don't remember which game he had it was referring to, but he said they used Fitz almost exclusively outside. And he had his worst, in his words, his worst game that since we were here with mental errors. And you have to figure that what Larry's being asked to do, if he's being asked to play every position, it might be taking its toll. And then it's causing him to suffer in his play at the position that he knows best. And so is he being misused? Maybe. I know that he's not getting the ball where he should. I mean, like you said, he's not getting targets and key spots, and he's not. And part of that I get is because of the injuries. So we haven't seen him getting separation from defensive backs like we have. And I know that a lot of that has to do with the hamstring. Hopefully that will change this week and then again after the bye. But I have to think that I have to hope that he's still an elite player that is just hampered by injury and still just learning what he needs to do and trying to get on the same page as his quarterback.
Well, and you look at it and you just kind of look at I pulled out my notes here since we were talking about it a little bit. You look at where his receptions have taken place, and I have charted down here that of his 32, I believe it is, only, I have to do the math in my head, sorry, only 14 of those 32 receptions have occurred over 10 yards down the field. So he caught the ball 10 yards or greater down the field. That's, you know, but I think his targets are at something like 40 of those are targets or something. Not that high. I think it's more around 25 of his targets are there. So you look at it. So he's not getting targets in that, you know, in those quadrants, 10 yards plus down the field. But he's also, when he is targeted, he's really not catching the ball. I mean, it's a 50-50 proposition. And we're talking about, you know, Larry Fitzgerald and Carson Palmer. We're not talking about Larry Fitzgerald and Ryan Lindley. You would hope that that would be more of an automatic, you know, even at the 10 to 15 yard route depth, those would be more automatic. And, you know, I think they're at a 48% clip right now. And that's just, you know, that's disappointing just based on what our expectation was for the season. And I think that might, you know, kind of be what the entire thing is with us and Fitz and Carson and the offense in general is, and I'm just as guilty as everybody else, you know, we had this expectation of, oh, we're going to see Fitz with 1,400, 1,500 yards again. And, you know, maybe, you know, like you said, Father Time has caught up with him a little bit. His hamstrings seem to be giving him a lot of problems. It's the first year of a new offense, a very complicated and complex and intricate offense. And it's the first year with a new quarterback who's learning the same offense. So it's, you know, it was probably the expectation level was too high for what was realistic, I think. And now that he's playing, you know, not great, but he's playing well enough, but we all are saying the same thing, what's wrong with Larry? And granted, yes, he's not making the impact that his contract would have you, you know, expect, but it's more of along the lines of, I think our expectations have just been, we overshot our expectations, as all fans do.
it's completely understandable. I mean, you if you look at Reggie Wayne's 2011, it looks a lot like Larry Fitzgerald's 2012. And Reggie Wayne's 2012 was, wow, it was back to Reggie Wayne numbers. And so everyone sees that in an offense where a rookie was running the offense, then you're thinking, hey, Carson Palmer's a veteran. No, he's not the athlete that Andrew Luck is, but he's ideally smarter, and knows more about football. And then you've got this great wide receiver in Larry Fitzgerald. And so that's what everyone put two and two together. It's what media members, it's what we said. Oh, hey, look, Reggie Wayne did this. And that's how Bruce Arians sold it to Larry. He said, look at Reggie. This is what he was doing. And then look what I got him to do. And so I can see why everyone is that. That's how Bruce sold him on changing positions. So, yeah, I'm hoping, much like I'm going to go back to 2011. 2011, he actually had a solid year. He had a lot of more plays down the field. He had bigger pass plays because he was down on receptions. He had what 80 receptions, and still put up mad amounts of yards. With Derek Anderson, he put up numbers as well. And so you have to think, well, hey, if he can get numbers with Kevin Cobb, John Skelton, and Derek Anderson, you know, he can put up with numbers with Carson Palmer. Do I think he's going to turn it around? Once he's healthy, I think we're going to see a better Fitz. And it's something that I have to keep wondering, and I no one's really asked the question, is it because these are supposed to be professionals. And I know hamstrings, the soft tissue injuries, are something that just happen in football. But Bruce Arians has one of the changes he did make to their practice routine and to their game routine is that they don't stretch as a team. He tells the players, you need to do that on your own. You need to be professional, responsible about that, about taking care of your body and doing your stretching beforehand. But, you know, I wonder if that's something that maybe, you know, has something to do with it, or heck, you know, you can't blame just getting old for a hamstring, because hamstring injuries can happen to anyone. I mean, and he's the type of player that gets through it rather than sitting out a game, and that's only hampered a little more. But you have to think, Fitz knows, and we know, any Fitz at 70-80% for 3 weeks perhaps is better for the team than having 2 weeks of fits at 100% and one with no fits at all. And because it shows leadership to his teammates. It shows fans that he cares and that he wants to. It does great things, but the fact that the talent level is there. And so I raised the question because I thought it is time to start wondering that, because we saw Anquan Boldin do the same thing. We saw Anquan Boldin in a sense that, well, he's getting up there in age, and then we let him go. But that Larry we kept, perhaps we were seeing the same thing. And I hope that's not the case. Looking ahead, they actually have a very doable next five games. They're at home against Atlanta, an Atlanta team that, I'm gonna have Dave Choate on Thursday from Falcon Hawk, and I was talking to him a little bit, as they are still hopeful for what they can do. They've been ravaged with injuries, but they've got Atlanta at home. Then they get the bye. It'll be great for the team, great for Larry Fitzgerald. Then you've got the Case Keenum-led Houston Texans coming to town. Then they go to Jacksonville. And then after that, they return home. So over the next 5 weeks, is it Indianapolis at home after that? Or is it... I thought I had that.
It's Indy after Jacksonville. And then they're at Philly.
That's right. And so they got 5 weeks, and you've got four games that really are quite doable. Three where you'd say, you've really got a legit chance. And then the fourth against Indianapolis where you say, a lot of things have to go well. And I'm gonna equate that game to the Ken Wisenhunt's first year when the Steelers came to town. And that puts them in a good situation. I equated kind of that game where the Cardinals can sneak a win out. Against a team where the coach came from before, who knows their personnel and knows their scheme and everything. So I'm really leery to say that they're still in it in the playoff race, even though they're 3-4. So yeah, technically they still are in the playoff race. And yes, there's going to be two wild card teams, but when you haven't won in the division, you have to go wonder, I guess winning the division is probably out of the picture. For you to maintain an inkling of hope for the playoffs in general, whether it be a wild card spot, what do they have to do in these next four games?
I think it starts with this week, like I said, you have to win this game. Not only do you have to win this game, you have to play really well, and you have to put up points. You want to see the offense come alive finally and do well and against a bad Falcons defense. And then from there, it's just kind of, it's beat teams that you should beat. You're at home against Texans, and, yeah, they gave the 7-0 Chiefs everything they could handle, but, we don't know if Matt Schaub will be back by then or not, and we don't know if Arian Foster and Ben Tate will be back, but let's just hope that they're not. I mean, you don't ever want to wish ill will or injuries on anybody, but let's just hope that they're not, going to be back. And then you go to Jacksonville. And I am admittedly terrified of this game. it is. And I mean, we've seen it. Well, we haven't seen it, and that's kind of what terrifies me. We haven't seen 0-16 said for one time, in the last, I think it's two decades. And now we're seeing 0-16, kind of staring us in the face, in their home stadium. And you want to walk out of these four games. You don't even want to say 2-2. You want to see 3-1, because even 3-1, that's only going to put you at 6-5. And while that's fine, if you told anybody, oh, they'll be 6-5 at the, after the Indy game, I think everybody would say, okay, I'll sign up for that. But you want to have to be at 6-5 because I think teams in the NFC are going to start turning it around. There's been a lot of injuries this season that have kind of benefited the Cardinals in keeping them in this race. But I mean, you look at it, the Panthers are still in it. The Rams are still in it. I know they don't have a quarterback, but the Lions and Bears, even the Redskins. The Redskins are only 2-4. I mean, there are really no teams outside of the Buccaneers and the Vikings that are out of it. I wouldn't even say the Giants are out of it at this point. So you want to see 3-1, 6-5 going into kind of that home stretch of at Philly versus St. Louis, at Tennessee, at Seattle, and against San Francisco. And, you know, just hope that Chip Kelly's offense is, you know, imploded. St. Louis doesn't, you know, find an answer at quarterback. And then Tennessee, Seattle, and San Francisco, that maybe San Francisco and Seattle have nothing to play for. I mean, that sounds terrible to say, but that's, you know, that's kind of where you're going to be at. But I think 3-1 out of this 4-week stretch is kind of a must, because then you go into a really hard 5-game stretch where you're on the road for 3 and you have San Francisco for 1. So,
and you almost have to, the truth is, you almost have to just scratch that off as a, well, no, actually it's Seattle, because they end the season at home against San Fran. They're on the road in Seattle.
Yeah.
Is how that one goes. But it, yeah, so if you go to ceiling, you're going to be pretty much, you almost have to chalk that up as a loss unless you're lucky. I was under the impression, my opinion was, is that they almost, for me, they really had to win one of the last two games. They can't really, while they're still mathematically in the playoff picture, I can't see a team going to the playoffs and ending up at best, you know, 1-6, 1-5 in their division. That just doesn't make sense to me. And so even though they're 3-4, and sure, they could win a few of these games and end up 9-7. And this is what I picked them to be at the beginning of the year. I picked them to be a 9-7 team that misses the playoffs. And I think the way the scheduling is hashing out, that it's a very, very distinct possibility to do that. But for that to happen, to even have an inkling at the playoffs, would they have to get 3 out of these 4. They have to somehow get 3 out of these next 4. And truthfully, I think for them to be able to put themselves in a very – they really need to win the next 4 that way. And as I'm playing futures here, the way I saw the season playing out is that they end up 9-5 going into the final two games of the season, and they lose them. It's not how I want it to happen. And they end up falling out of the playoff season with a last week loss against the Niners, because it's just, I don't see them, unless they absolutely have nothing to play for. And I think at that point of the season, both Seattle and San Francisco are going to be at each other's throat trying to win that division. So I really can't see them not playing for anything. But truthfully, they need to win 3, have to win 3 to even be considered in the picture. 6-5 is a good place. 5-6 doesn't feel as good. And 7-4 would actually honestly be better. If any wins that you can stock up at all, and since our wins have not been of the impressive fashion anyway, they honestly need to win. They really need to win all 4, especially to pick up that Indy win, because that would be an impressive win. Beating Atlanta at home is not going to be impressive. Beating Houston at home is not going to be impressive. Beating Jacksonville is not impressive at all. So, minimum, they have to get 3, and I'm going to say they really need all 4 games if we have really any chance at a playoff spot.
Yeah, and you look at it, and you know, like you said, you wish one of those last two games would have been a game they could have pulled off. Now you look back at it, and you know, they kind of have to kick themselves at that St. Louis game. And I know, you know, a couple bounces go a different way and Detroit or Tampa, and they're 1-6 instead. And I know it's just the opposite. You know, a couple of bounces go the way, and they're 4-3. But you look at it now, and you don't want any more of those games where, oh, what could have been. You need some decisiveness. You need that defense of, you know, that defense of the Tampa Carolina game to show up, and you need an offense to show up. You know, probably the offense from that St. Louis game to show up. And from there, you're hoping that things will just kind of bounce around to where you want them. So,
So, well, we've got a close-up shop here for the night. We're hitting basically the end of our show. So we've got the next games coming up. We need four. We've got four very winnable games, three very winnable games, and one that should be a challenge that they really need to get. We've been talking Carson Palmer. We've talked offensive line. We talked the good and the bad of the Seattle game. Arizona Cardinals fans, you can hear us. You can find us on iTunes and on Stitcher Radio if you're interested in downloading these episodes automatically. This is Revenge of the Birds Radio. We'll be back on the air Thursday night late, as I will bring on Dave Choate from the Falcoholic, and we will talk about the upcoming game with the Falcons. We'll be at 10 p.m. Arizona time. Probably a little bit after that, we'll get on the air. On behalf of Seth Cox, I am Jess Root. This is Revenge of the Birds Radio. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great night.
Good night, everybody.
You've been listening to Revenge of the Birds. Keep the conversation going by visiting revengeofthebirds.com. Follow us on Twitter at Revenge of Birds. You can also find us on iTunes at facebook.com/Revenge of the Birds.